several times a day instead of once a day, and with less resources and less people.
I want to open this to the audience. So if you have questions, you know, find a microphone. And while you're doing that, I'll just throw out one more thing. But please feel free, because we've got another half hour or so, and I'd love to hear from the audience if you have questions for the panelists. I want to get back to some of the original subject matter that was going to be part of this before Katrina hit, and that's how the government has become so very sophisticated at media spin, putting out video news releases which get picked up by, for instance, small stations in the middle of nowhere that have to fill their newscast that night, and they go, oh, this is already done, this piece. You know, I think that there's more education about that now. The use of language, clean skies, healthy forests, it's kind of insidious. So how do you deal with that? I mean, how do we get, if you're going to engage the public more, Merrill, isn't there a danger that this sounds pompous, doesn't it, when I say only journalists have the professional credentials to screen these things. But, I mean, how do you screen them when all this is out there? Go ahead, Merrill.
Well, none of what I'm suggesting minimizes the value of important journalism and reporting, but yet this is another example where we have the capability of running stuff by various publics in a way we never had before, and we must do it. And it's simpler than ever because we're all savvy about using these tools. I think almost everybody in this room is probably savvier than I am about it. And we should be doing that. We should be testing our assumptions in a variety of ways we don't today. We should be seeking out information, data, and feedback in ways we're not. We should be making our email addresses available, for God's sakes, which lots of large news institutions haven't really done yet. So I think in terms of video news releases and everything else, it's not that hard to check stuff anymore. And as we all know, search is a wonderful tool.
Yes, Jay?
Judy, I would say that the question you've raised raises perhaps the biggest challenge to institutional professional journalism today. Because answering it requires breaking in very clear and conscious ways major conventions of journalism. If I could just take 1 minute. It seems to me that something, propaganda, which began to be developed in the early 20th century, its tools were used first by advertising and then by politicians and interest groups, has now become an obvious and frequently relied on tool of government. And it overwhelms the conventions of journalism because journalists will report factually what they know to be misrepresentations and call that good journalism. And it's going to be a very difficult thing to do. But calling propaganda propaganda, calling misleading language for what it is a very difficult thing. And I think it's one of the very big challenges that we face.
Okay. I feel like my old radio talk show days. We have callers on the line. those dials are blank and one light goes and you're so excited. And it's... Okay. I'm going to take the fellow who's been standing up there at the back first. And remember, questions, not statements, and keep it succinct.
And identify yourself.
And identify yourself, yes. Is it on?
Is this mic on?
Oh, hold on.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Dan Glick. I'm a freelance author and journalist based in Colorado. And I guess I see it as a pretty easy thing for us to self-flagellate here and wring our hands about the failures of journalism, and I don't want to minimize that there are a lot of institutional problems right now. But, you know, I look up there and I see Mark and his work and Andy's climate change work, and I guess I'd venture to say there isn't a journalist in this room that hasn't written an I told you so story. And I guess my great frustration in some of the conversations I've had here is that when we do go through all the hoops and we do write these stories, there's no responsiveness on the part of government. And it seems like in this administration in particular, there seems to be a wanton disregard for anything we have to say, even if we do it well and we get through everything. So
the question.
I'm old enough to say I remember when it seems like journalism actually worked in its relationship with government. Why isn't it working now?
Why isn't journalism working now?
Why isn't government responding to all the stories that we're writing and exposing the Corps of Engineers or the toxic runoff or all the things that we know? Nobody in this room was surprised at what happened in New Orleans.
I would suggest that in part it did work, okay? As bad as things were in New Orleans, the reality is that in the years after our series ran in 2002, they did get fixed the contraflow plan to get the people who did have cars out. It worked. It worked extremely well. It was an evacuation that had never, ever been seen anywhere in this country, the amount of people that left the New Orleans metro area. That worked. I'd like to take credit for part of that. It's terrible to be in the I told you so market, but that's part of being a journalist, and we can't lead them any better than what we're doing.
Meryl?
I just like to ask what the evidence is that it used to work and now it doesn't.
And Bibi, did you want to?
Well, I was going to say, I whether government responds to the press, if we're not getting the public behind, if we're not getting them to push for it, too, I mean, the government isn't supposed to respond to us necessarily. They're supposed to respond to the public. And the question are we engaging the public in a way that makes these issues relevant to their lives? And it's a real challenge, I think, as Andy pointed out, with the kinds of environmental issues that we're having to deal with now. How do you make them relevant to somebody so that they do get upset and they do press their elected officials to do it?
Okay, and let's go down here. And just a reminder, SEJ members first in line. I see tags here, so go ahead.
Yes, my name is Leopoldo Miranda. I work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington, D.C. And one of my questions is, maybe it's not totally related to this discussion, but how do you incorporate different cultures, me being a Hispanic? I don't see how the media is reaching out to other cultures, Hispanic, Asians, and it's not just a translation service or anything like that. Basically what I'm asking is how do you incorporate, how do you reach out to other cultures?
Anybody on that? I'll answer it for you. I think there is a huge gap, and I live in Los Angeles, where the number one television station is Telemundo. And I think we try to catch on for a while. We'll do Spanish translation on our World News Tonight, and that lasts for 6 weeks, but we find out we're not. Here's an example. The Hispanic Journalists Association last year put out their brownout report looking at who does the most in terms of network news. And I was shocked that I was named, that I had the most Hispanic-oriented stories on. I had five. And I was, cited for this great. It was embarrassing. So I think you're right. I think we have to do more to bring in that. But I am going to remind everybody, SEJ members first, so if we could. Let's go over here real quick.
I'm Christy George from Oregon Public Broadcasting. And I think one of the take-home messages from Katrina was that stories based on science turned out to be accurate at a time when what the White House is saying is that science is questionable. And I wonder how environmental journalists can hang on to and develop their spine when it comes to science.
Andy, do you want to tackle that one?
Well, the problem is that the science, it still leads you into a complicated arena. It's all the science of where hurricanes are going to strike is statistics. It's very hard to. In fact, New Orleans probably had a 1 in 1,000s chance of this storm, even though the inevitability along that coast of strikes like this is very high. And so once you cross that boundary and get into the accurate science and get that into your story, you're talking about a very fuzzy story that isn't going to make people run and start dumping dirt on levees to make them higher. So it's challenging. It's like the science doesn't lead you to, even though the science itself is powerful, it doesn't lead you necessarily to to the kinds of actions you expect society might want to take.
The science stuff was great. The problem is that it doesn't necessarily tell you what the proper policy should be, and that's where you actually have the falling down of the government. Is everybody knew this stuff was going to happen, but it didn't tell you what the proper policy is going to be. One of the things I find fascinating about this particular story right now is that the people who didn't do anything in Washington for years are now going to be heroes when they vote the $220 billion, and they're going to be rewarded at the polls, even though they screwed up in the first place. I think that's a terrible story, and that no one seems to be covering.
Yeah, a very quick add-on just to amplify that. Most of the scientists I talk to say the Ninth Ward and some other parts of New Orleans should not be inhabited.
Exactly.
But guess what? They're going to be inhabited.
Yes, home improvement shows will come in and do it. I'm not kidding. Watch it happen. Yes, let's take...
My address is...
Not too proud. Okay, go right down here.
Yes, I'm Dick Russell. I'm an author and a freelance journalist. And what I'd like to see some of you address is this, what I see as this increasing concentration of media in either corporate or even ideological hands at the top. I mean, you got Clear Channel buying up all these stations, which obviously has a right-wing agenda. GE owns NBC. Tomlinson, the whole thing. PBS was very clear with, you know, I think a reason why I'm sure Bill Moyers will address it tomorrow, why he stepped down from now. And so what I want to know is how much of a problem do you feel ownership with an agenda is in terms of your covering the stories today?
Jay?
Well, I'll take... that at two levels. First, I think that the problem is not consolidation per se, but who's doing the consolidating. And what you have is essentially an institution of democracy at all levels in our nation that has been moved into corporations which do not have as their fundamental purpose public service. The corporations are doing what they were set up to do, which is making money, and they are turning these news organizations which support businesses into businesses whose priority is not news. That's number one. Number two, my view is changing, not on Fox News, but on more journalism with a position. And I had that view coming back. Nancy and I went through London on the way back from Spain a few weeks ago. And just in reading papers at Heathrow with different political, clear, stated different political positions, I saw a healthier debate about the war in Iraq than I've ever seen in American newspapers. And we need that. And there were also people who were willing to call lies lies, to call misstatements misstatements. And I actually think we're at a point now where our democracy could use a good dose of a new type of journalism.
Well, in the name of fair and balance, we often forget to tell the truth. Merrill?
I also have to respond to that by making the point that concentration is here. It's a fact of life. And I think what we need to do in our profession is to train all of us, especially those of us in school, to think about our careers differently and to teach entrepreneurialism and not simply preparing us to go into large organizations for which there are going to be fewer and fewer well-paying jobs. I think journalists today have to think about controlling their destiny when the opportunities arise, to think about the entrepreneurial opportunities that ubiquitous distribution makes available to people, and to look carefully at what's happening in citizen journalism, blogging, and the whole new world in the context of their own careers, because concentration and fewer jobs are a certainty when it comes to large journalistic institutions.
I'm glad we're not going to disagree about digital stuff. I want to disagree on the basic point. Concentration, as it's happening, is corrupting an institution of democracy. And the response to that loss is not learning how to be entrepreneurial. The response to the corruption of journalism as a public service is not being entrepreneurial. It's trying to fight back in the same way healthcare has done to its corporatization, and publics or other public institutions that have been so threatened. I mean, I do think there's something there that needs to be done. Something very bad is happening.
Great. Let's go up top here. Yes, ma'am.
Just really quick, I'm sorry to come up. I'm a student here at the University of Texas. I'm a journalism major, and I have to go to work, so I wanted to get a little thing voiced. That was actually my question about corporate conglomeration, because I see that as a huge downfall. So my question is stolen, but I have one quick thing, is that I'm on the Internet several hours a day. If I didn't have to get the newspaper for class, I probably wouldn't, and I'm a journalism student. And I know that most other journalism students are that way. In fact, my professor wouldn't let us bring the online syndication of the paper. Anyway, just wanted to say, you know, is there something, you know, there also is streaming on the radio as far as, like, radio broadcasts. Just wanted to say that, being 20 years old, you're all journalists, I think there's something that, I'm not with you on a lot of places, so just so you know, but I'm glad you answered the question about the corporate conglomeration. Thank you.
And I'm sure you'll do fine.
I think she's expressing the important generational difference,
yes,
though, for the
yes
stuff that...
I just have a quick poll question here, to my all due respect to my broadcast colleagues here. How many of you actually watch the evening news on television, broadcast evening news?
If I don't raise my hand, is that all right?
Okay, so it's about half. Yeah. And the thing is that's about the proportion of the country that does, too, and it's going to go down. There's too many other sources of information.
My cab driver coming here, 78 years old, was talking about, we were talking about this very thing. I said, do you watch the evening news? Oh, no, I don't watch TV anymore. I said, why is that? He goes, well, I got a computer, didn't you?
I'd like to respond just react to the last questioner, and of course I understand that, and I don't understand that because I necessarily live that life. I understand it because I have a 19-year-old and a 21-year-old, and I understand what their lives are like, at least to the extent any dad can. But that is the reality. That is the reality about American newspapers, and really focuses on their challenge. And to Jay's point addressed at me, I'm appalled by concentration as well. I just think there are some facts of life, like declining readership for newspapers, that we have to accept and deal with, and some things are just not going to change. And pardon me for being cynical about that.
We're already working on podcasting at NPR. I mean, it really, you just reckon, I think she makes a really important point about the generational difference of where people are going to get.
I don't have an iPod yet. Okay.
I'm sorry. Just one other point, and that is that, yes, the readership of daily newspapers is dropping, and there's no question about that. But the other piece of that reality is that when you go to the grocery store, you're going to want those coupons in your hand, and that's where they are. They're in the newspaper. They're either delivered with the newspaper or they're published in the newspaper. And you can get them online, that's true, but most people get them delivered, you know, still to their door. And that is, you know, that is one of the problems that newspapers are facing now is as we move more away from newspapers, how do we capture that way of doing it and combine the services? And it's going to be a difficult problem.
Yes, down here.
Yes, hi. I'm Margie Haley with Sustainable Dallas. First of all, I want to thank you and all of the media and every journalist in the audience for being who you are. You were our Paul Revere in New Orleans on the Gulf Coast while our officials were just scratching their heads. It's just shameful.
Your question.
You are more powerful than you think you are, whether it's electronic or written or TV. There is a way to revolutionize our automobile situation with gas prices getting scarier and scarier.
I hate to play Alex Trebek here.
I know.
Put it in the form of a question.
Are you all familiar with the Austin Energy plug-in hybrid car campaign?
No.
You need to. Do a Google. It's a way we will be plugging our cars into our outlets instead of filling it up with gas.
Yeah, our newspaper actually before the storm did run a story, and there have been a number of national stories about the plug-in.
I didn't know about the Austin program, but we have done stories on that as well. Yeah, yes, sir.
Jim Motivalli from E Magazine.
The national polls consistently show that the voters basically think the two parties are about equal in what they do for the environment, which is probably appalling to a lot of people here. But that's what the polls show. And they also show that environmental issues are like number 10 on the kind of things that people vote on. And on the same line, fuel economy was like number 10 in what people thought about when they bought a car. That's probably changed now. Mm-hmm. But this attitude of the public that the environment is getting better and it doesn't matter which politician is in probably has to do with their tuning out of environmental issues, that everything's getting better, basically. So I was wondering if this influences newsroom decisions. Like, if the people say they don't really care about environmental issues or watching the coverage, does that affect the way editors assign environmental stories? Are they letting the public lead on that? Or
I'm really glad you asked this question. Andy?
Yes. And I'll give you one quick example. A couple of years ago, someone who is no longer the editor-in-chief of the New York Times, executive editor, had commissioned a series of stories on climate change. And it was kind of steaming along. We were rolling along, getting it together. And then he wasn't the editor anymore, and another editor came in, and someone else under that editor came in and saw the outlines of this project and literally kind of said, do we want this much gray space in the newspaper devoted to such a complicated subject? You know, and clearly you got the sense that the front page, this was not friendly stuff to put on the front page of a newspaper, and it didn't happen.
Well, as an environment editor, I'm in a unique situation perhaps in that we have made it one of our prime beats, and so
we don't have an environment editor.
What I will tell you is really tough, though. We had to hire a reporter because we could not get anybody in Washington to cover it as a political story. And believe me, when the campaigns happen, the political people don't see it as an issue. Fortunately, our higher up people have seen it, so it's, you know, thank God.
At our newspaper, we're sort of the contra flow to that whole idea. Mm-hmm. Just about every part of your life living in New Orleans has something to do with the environment, even before Katrina. And many of the major issues have some sort of environmental spin. And it's, whether it's Formosan termites, invasive species, tearing down your house, or the what's causing the risk of hurricanes to increase is the coastal erosion, or the hope of thousands of jobs because of the coastal restoration program. They're all environmental stories, and we've been able to continue to do the coverage even in the worst of times.
And I would echo what Mark says, is that you have to make the story somehow speak to people's lives, and then they aren't really hard to get on.
You have to learn how to pitch it responsibly and do it without hyping them also.
Well, yeah, pitching stories. I mean, I teach journalism, so I spend a great deal of time on the pitch because I will call or pitch a wild salmon in Jeopardy story or the dams in the West to people in New York, and they go, well, I don't get it. I mean, there's plenty of salmon at my store. I mean, I've actually had that. I said, well, wild salmon, it's bigger than eating, But, it really is, you have to figure out how to make it affect them. They should care about wild salmon in a river they may never see.
Well, they also have to care about if every wild salmon disappeared, what would it mean? What would it do to me? And it's a hard question. I mean,
it is a hard question.
And that gets to the difficulty of the task before us.
Yes. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, maybe my question's a little easier. I'm Katie Mandes with the Pew Center on Global Climate Change. To the extent that each organization
blue
up here,
cards,
each...
Wait. Blue cards, members only.
The working press is supposed to get priority.
If we have a chance, we'll get to you, okay?
I apologize.
We need to get some of the members in. Okay. Are you an SEJ member? Okay. Let's go. Okay.
I apologize if this is a little narrow, but on behalf of my broadcasting friend, Bibi, you mentioned the push for shorter stories, and as an environmental reporter at a member station, this affects me. The smaller the holes are, the more they scream at me if I go over 4 minutes and 30. What's behind this push? Is it actually research or just this perception that we have to be like all other broadcasters?
will partly say it's research. I probably put more long stories on than anybody, but it's I think part of it is they feel that people don't listen for as long. I think we've been guilty of putting long stories on that are too long, and they don't hold people's attention. They haven't really explained to us what it is. Part of it is the clocks of the show because of, sorry, this is so inside, but stations want more time to break out, to do their own thing. And that means that we have this big a space. It divides really easily by four.
Yes.
So the stations can own up a little responsibility for that.
Isn't there also a perception, like everything else, that we want to get younger, and younger means shorter because young people, they tell us, don't have attention spans?
I'm sure that's part of it, too.
Yeah. I'm thinking about starting a website called geezernews.com. I've actually bought the URL address, if any of you are interested. For people with an attention span, that demographic nobody wants, us. Okay. Yeah.
How you doing? I'm Dan Hendrick. I work at Greenwich Time. That's a Tribune paper in Greenwich, Connecticut. And I'm happy to see a lot of young journalists here, and I'm talking with them yesterday and today about what's next. So I would ask all of you to be prospective for the future generation of environmental journalism. Where are, not only, you know, self-serving, where are the opportunities going to be? What, you know, how do we increase an appetite for this kind of news? And yes, where, you know, NPR aside, everything else is gloom and doom out there in terms of this news and our jobs. Where is there, you know, a positive happening?
Andy?
Well, I haven't totally given up on grown-ups yet, but I've just finished a book for sort of junior high and high school age kids on the North Pole and climate change. So I'm working my way down the food chain toward that younger market.
Because I think
the decisions that are the thing, some of these issues are not going to be grappled with successfully by the current generation.
And
I mean, the other thing, the paper is trying. Everyone is trying to find ways to target.
You're wondering where the opportunities will be for environmental reporters, and
don't undersell NPR. We are looking for younger people too.
And I would use the word Katrina a lot right now.
The other thing, it's sort of ironic. My son had to evacuate from his apartment in Metairie outside of New Orleans and relocated to Atlanta and now is in West Palm Beach looking for a job. But while he's been doing that, he's been earning some money by doing a blog and has been blogging on Katrina almost continuously in coffee houses and is making money off of that. And that is part of the future that we're looking at, is sort of this independent blogging network that's out there that people are going to get involved in.
Thus my point that my friend Jay Harris disputes, that if we don't teach journalists to seize the opportunities at hand, I'm not saying we should abandon journalism or journalismification or anything else, but we need to think either as either within the organizations we work in as entrepreneurs, how do you develop the right newsletter that maybe people will in fact buy within the context of the Chicago Tribune or within the context of your own organization? That's an entrepreneurial kind of thinking that we historically haven't been very good at. And the companion point is, how do we teach kids in school to seize the moment like his clever son and go out and create products on our own that people will want to read and use?
I don't disagree with that, and I want to be clear about this. My point is this. If you look at what happened last week or 2 weeks ago at the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Philadelphia Daily News and the San Jose Mercury News, each of which had their news staffs cut by more than 10%, and I think we can focus on ourselves entrepreneurially or our professional interest as the institutions themselves wither to the point that they are inconsequential. And my point simply is that we have to attend to the vitality of the institution as a whole and not just focus on what we do that day to be better communicators.
Okay. Yes.
My name is Amelia Ascari from the Detroit Free Press. And, Mr. Harris, I have been really mulling over what you said a few minutes ago about the importance of fighting the fight from the inside. And it's fascinating to me to hear you say that, knowing your history as the former top guy at the San Jose Mercury News who stood up to budget cuts that were proposed from above and lost his job. So
I think about the, so I'm wondering, what exactly do you mean? Do you think we should all get up and walk out, or
well,
what?
Well, no. To begin with, I wasn't fired. I quit. And the reason I quit was that I wasn't willing to lie to the people who worked for me. And the job that I was asked to do, this was the job going forward, was to convince people who believed in me and to whom I was committed that what we would be doing with fewer and fewer resources would be better and better journalism. And I'm not prepared to tell that lie. And because I was the senior executive of the paper, that was the only choice I had. But the argument should be going on at the front line between reporters and desk editors, between desk editors and their reporters, and particularly, and to Merle's point and others who made it here, engaging the community. In the end, if the community doesn't demand that it be better, we'll lose.
Exactly.
Period. Yeah. So I think there are ample opportunities to fight from inside, and if we don't fight, we will lose.
Thank you for the question. Yes, sir.
Hi, I'm Peter Thompson, a radio journalist from Boston, an author, and a board member, which is why I felt I had to sort of step in and just plead for blue card members to have priority in questioning. But sorry for the stepping, for being the hammer there. speaking of the hammer, our business, our profession faces such incredibly broad challenges that it's hard to form a coherent question sometimes. And I've been sitting here very frustrated about the limits of the debate and the discussion here, but that's mostly because we can't possibly cram it into an hour and a half or even a week and a half. But I was trying to get at what some of the fundamental challenges are that we're facing, and I think that one really is the incredibly deep cynicism in our society today, that no one has any faith in anything except their own self-interest anymore. I personally think that a lot of that has been cultivated from the top down, but and I think it's our mission as journalists to try to fight cynicism. And I'm wondering, you know, this is not a question about technology. It's not really a question about the economics of one business model versus another, but how, as citizen participants in our society, do we fight cynicism and get people feeling that they can make a difference in their society anymore?
I'd like to see Ron take that.
I have a way of thinking that I'm going to steal from a colleague of mine, Jonathan Rauch, who wrote a wonderful book that I recommend to you all called Kindly Inquisitors. And the way he thought about our enlightenment society exists on three pillars, the first pillar of which is democracy, which is how we decide who gets to wield coercive power. The second one is capitalism, which is how we decide who gets what. And the third one, he says, that is very neglected, is what he called liberal science, which is how we decide what is true. And he made a very powerful argument all the way up that from, you know, activist pamphlets to peer-reviewed science journals, that process, that set of institutions you keep talking about, is how we ultimately figure out how things, whether something is being said is true or not. And it takes a while. The daily paper is, you know, part of that process, and it doesn't always get it right. There are not 10,000 bodies floating in New Orleans, thank goodness. But it is a way of trying to do that. I'm not a cynic, and I don't know that the public is cynical. On the other hand, I have sat in newsrooms where my colleagues at least affected cynicism, and I don't know if that's part of the culture of journalism as such. And I do worry about that sometimes, because they're cynical because they actually talk to politicians and they know that these people are lying to them. So, and there's reason for the cynicism, and the question and the model actually liked what Jay Harris was saying here. Is as flawed as in many ways the British model of journalism may be what we're going back to, because that was what the model of American journalism was in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. All those newspapers, Democrat that, Republican that, they were Republican and Democrat this, that, or the other thing, and we may end up that way again.
Bibi,
I had one little idea, and that is, I mean, it's not to sound Pollyanna-ish, but I think when we go out to do our stories day to day, is that it's so easy to tell these stories as these battles, and
right.
Whether we can try to go out and find, I think there is common ground with the players, and whether we can be approaching the stories a little bit more from, well, where is there the common ground? It's not our job to sort of bring everybody together to sing kumbaya, but I'm wondering is if that could help reduce a little of that public cynicism to sort of, and give them a little bit of hope that some of this stuff could be, there are some solutions out there.
Mark?
My response to the concern about cynicism is Donald Newhouse. And I know that's a strange way of saying things, but Donald Newhouse recreated the Mobile Register. Donald Newhouse is the guy who told our newspaper quietly, silently, and effectively that we could continue to do the sorts of reporting that we needed to do with the space that we needed to get those series out, including Washing Away. He's a key player in this business. He's a private, you know, a family-owned business. And that is, you know, that's the positive side to this business, is that there are people like that who are very quietly doing their job and making sure that a lot of us are able to do ours.
I think that the answer to that question for me is to look at the public's response to the coverage of Katrina. When people are told something that's real and honest and provocative and compelling in the moment, they respond. And if it happens to them, it affects them. I think the cynicism goes away. I mean, if Encana knocks on the door of a rancher in Wyoming and says, we'll be here to drill next week, and you have nothing you can say about it, people across the country care about that story because, I mean, that's about somebody knocking on your door and saying you have no right here. And if it's told well, you know, somebody in Boston will care about that rancher in Wyoming. So not that there's anything wrong with Encana knocking on the door. But you see what I'm saying. I think it's about telling the story responsibly.
Can I just say one other thing, and that is that I would be remiss without adding that the other antidote to that concern about cynicism is the outpouring of efforts by newsrooms across this nation that sent us gifts. At the Times-Picayune, and the Homer Courier that opened its arms to us as we got out of New Orleans and set up a newsroom for us out of nothing, and LSU, which provided us with everything we needed to run a newspaper for a week, including dorm rooms and food, and that's... That's an antidote that we needed and was there for us.
May we go to 11:30, by the way? Can I take this to 11:30? Good. Oh, okay. Over here. Oh, two in. We'll get in two. Go ahead.
I'll be quick. I'm Diane Sines. Dale, do you mind? I'm not a member, but I would love to ask a quick question.
We're down to two questions.
It's simply about the revolving door of agency officials.
Could you come afterwards and we'll talk to you? Okay, great.
Sure. I'd just like to see more of those stories.
Hi. Sorry. Dale Willman of Field Notes Productions. My question has sort of lost a lot of steam after Mark there, and I got to say that Mark and what they've done is they're amazing heroes to me. I'm just incredibly impressed and a great deal of respect for all that you guys have done. Anyway, my question is simply the frustration with panels like this frequently that spend a lot of time focusing on delivery vehicles. And Meryl, bless your heart, but you know it doesn't matter to me if it's a podcast or a blog or whatever. What matters to me is relevance, and I think in this last statement we started talking about that I'd love for you to address a little bit more about how do we regain relevance in our listeners and viewers and readers' lives to, again, increase our significance to them.
Well, I'll be brief. I mean, and everyone should take a shot at this, please, but I wasn't simply talking about delivery mechanisms. I was talking about using the tools we have at hand to engage. And relevance, I think, for us in our future is about a level of engagement that we're not used to doing. I mean, I remember when I would write stories and I would hand them to the editor or would hand them to the production desk, and that was the end of my engagement with the story often and the end of my engagement with the public would be a letter that would trickle in, or three letters if I was lucky, in the snail mail weeks later. We can't practice that form of engagement any longer. We have to be proactively engaged in ways we're not today, and that's not about simply delivery systems. It's about our approach to our craft.
I would also add to that, I have a friend, Wayne Friedman, a wonderful reporter up at KGO in San Francisco, who calls this the Benihana trap. Watch out for all the display of the knife work, because at the end you want that teriyaki to taste good. In other words, we're still talking about the content of the product, so don't be too dazzled by the delivery system. But I think actually Merrill and I agree on this. We are working together on this News 21 initiative. It involves five major journalism schools around the country to try to come up with models for the future and engage young people. But it's all about substantive content of the stories. So we are in tune on this. It's just that he often talks about that more than, and I often talk, we'll talk more about the story, but working together. Yes,
Judy, just a broad point. We use the word stories for a reason, and we are storytellers. And when storytellers experience people leaving the room because their stories are not compelling, one of the things they have to ask is, how could we tell stories better? I was thinking when Bibi mentioned the question, what would happen if there were no wild salmon? The question that was asked by Rachel Carson 60 years ago, what would happen if there was a silent spring? Mm-hmm. And that was journalism that had engaged in a powerful way, and it engaged citizens.
I'd like to just have each of the panelists do 30 seconds on, is that all right? To wrap it up? Okay. I'm looking at my guides down here. Just give me 30 seconds on now that we've hashed this out, optimism, pessimism, future, that sort of thing.
A despairing optimist. Rene DeBose coined that phrase a long time ago. He had a column on it. And that's, I just keep circling back. But I do think with all these new tools, we also have to reexamine the old ones. The things that get a story onto page one are the things that can also build the cynicism of the reader. The eternal journalistic need to search for the conflict. We want the conflict to be up top of the story. Even we don't necessarily focus on the facts, the truth. We're more interested in the conflict quite often. And balance, the bane of balance, which can destroy any sense of what we actually understand about the world. So I'm just saying we have to watch the old tools as we examine the new ones.
Mark?
I guess I'll throw it out as a challenge to the audience. It's really up to you guys, both the journalists in the room and the non-journalists in the room, to ensure that newspapers, TV, radio do their jobs. And I will throw out to you the same mantra that I give to scientists when I talk to them when they complain about being misquoted, and that is, when you don't like what you see, you need to call the publisher and tell them. And that goes for people inside the newsroom as well as outside.
Phoebe?
I would sort of echo my colleagues, and I guess I ultimately, as much as journalists love to complain, we love to say how horrible editors are and how tough the publishers are. But I love my colleagues in this profession, and I think that's where my faith comes, that I think there are really great people doing these things, and everybody's really committed to it. And so I think ultimately I'm optimistic about the profession.
I am optimistic about the profession as well, because I see educational institutions changing. I see wise media companies beginning to make smart investments, not simply in buying new wires or hardware or approaches, but in trying to change outdated cultures. The newsroom culture that we've grown up in needs a fix, and I see some of that starting to come. So I'm optimistic that there are very good things happening, and I'm also very optimistic because I think the blogosphere is an optimistic culture, because it is about empowerment, and sometimes there's a lot of stuff to sort through to get to the bottom of it, but when you read what people are writing about their lives and their views of their lives, they're embracing empowerment in ways that I think are ultimately encouraging both for journalism and for the world we live in.
Ron?
I'm not a despairing optimist. I'm an optimist. I basically see the proliferation of outlets for the kinds of information that we can find and ferret out and provide as stories, good stories to tell people. I don't think just because we happen to have the internet doesn't mean we can't tell a good story. This is crazy. I don't know what it is to be what the journalism students are feeling now, the job pressures. I hope that you're not just looking to get a job at Time or Newsweek and, you know, write one of those wonderful cover stories on Jesus Christ or spirituality or something that we see proliferating all over the place. There's a lot of other stuff going on out in the world, and you know it. And I'm very optimistic that you'll be able to do a good job out there.
Here's why I'm hopeful. American history is replete with examples of institutions, public institutions that have been corrupted, of essential values that have been debased, which have been reclaimed by sustained public pressure. It's happened before in our history, and it could happen again. And it requires a lot of work. It occurs over time. But if we want it to happen, and I think we all do, it will.
I'm optimistic because I'm teaching journalism now, and I have to be true to my optimism because I see these hopeful faces, and they love storytelling. They love being in the thick of it. They love it for all the right reasons, and I have to give them an optimistic path to follow. So thank you all for being such a wonderful audience.
Thank you.